In today's episode of Higher Learning, we're joined by CPG marketing executive Ken Krasnow. Ken and I discuss a whole range of topics, everything from how you can have complementary but opposite skills to have a high-performing team, how you can help your leadership to have an appetite for risk, even the origins of Mountain Dew. We covered a range of topics in this discussion. I am so excited for you to listen in. Welcome to another episode of Higher Learning. I am your host, Oz Rashid, and today we are joined by a very special guest. Today we are joined by Ken Krasnow. Ken's a marketing executive, formerly worked at PepsiCo and Henkel, most recently the chief marketing officer at Dr. Breger's. How you doing, Ken?
Awesome, doing great. It's wonderful to be here with you today.
I am so grateful for you coming on, brother. I love your energy. I'm so glad that we connected. You know, when we were doing our pre-talk, we were talking a little bit about how you have this obsession with continuing to grow, right? And pushing your boundaries. And so the first thing that came in my mind when you told me that is, what are you doing in your personal life to push the boundaries? We're going to talk a lot about your professional career, but I'm so interested to know, what are you doing in your personal life to push your boundaries?
Yeah, I think that's a great question. I love talking about that type of thing. I'd kick it off probably with a quote that really drives me, both personally and professionally. And that's by General Eric Shinseki, right? You probably heard this one, but it goes, if you dislike change, you're going to dislike irrelevance even more.
Ooh, I like that.
So, you know, that always reminds me of the importance of stepping out of my comfort zone and embracing new ideas and behaviors, whether that's personally and professionally.
Yeah, I love that. And one of the things that, you know, we talk a lot about hiring, we're going to talk about hiring in a little bit, but I think one of the biggest mistakes that companies don't take into account when they're bringing somebody into their organization is that things are not static. And so a lot of times when you are interviewing for a role, the person, you might hire somebody and be like, they're going to do so great in this role with this team, with this manager. It's going to be amazing. And then invariably, especially in the world we live in now, things are going to change and there's going to be different dynamics. And now the person that you hired that was perfect for situation A, all of a sudden you're wondering why they're not perfect for situation B. And so that ability to be adaptive and adapt to change is really, really important. So I love that quote. Like what are you like? Are you big like on the like workout circuit? Are you big on like travel? Like how are you pushing yourself though in your personal life?
So you know what? In my personal life, I'm really into sports, and I'm really into spending as much time in nature as I possibly can. And I look for those sports that are both physically demanding and also mentally demanding, like really technical. You know, I find it really challenging to be able to, you know, think while I'm under some physical duress. So for example, trail running. I used to do a lot of triathlons, right? And there's definitely a technical component to triathlons. But I switched to trail running because that's even more technical. Mm-hmm. You know, that race could end really quickly with one wrong turn over a root or a rock. So you've got to constantly have, you know, your head kind of down, looking at what's right in front of you, picking your head up from time to time to see what other racers are doing. And I find that really exhilarating. One of the sports too that I love, which you may find a little bit, it may surprise you, is fly fishing. Fly fishing may not be the most physically challenging, but certainly from a mental perspective, oh my goodness. And actually this weekend, I found myself all wrapped up in my fly fishing line, and it was knotted everywhere because the fish were jumping out of the water and I got excited and I made a mistake. And what I could have done was I could have just cut the line, retied the flies, and gotten out on the river quicker. But I said, you know what? Here's a great opportunity to practice calm, cool collectiveness, you know, under a bit of stress. And so what I did was I just stayed with it. I slowly untied myself from those knots, you know, retied and got out there and got a beautiful rainbow trout.
Fly fishing as an allegory of life. It feels like every fly fisherman I've ever met also has that kind of that thought process. My father-in-law loves fly fishing. I assume you've seen A River Runs Through It.
Of course.
Great movie. Amazing movie. Brad Pitt. I don't think a lot of people have seen that Brad Pitt movie, but I watched that when I was a kid. My dad loved it. I loved it. Great, great movie. Are you big into like, you're not into like survivalist or anything like that? Like, do you go out and stay out in nature like in any type of duration or no?
No, I don't do that. The closest thing I've done to kind of risking, you know, a life and limb is really surfing. And we're not known for tremendously large waves here on the East Coast, but they can get pretty big at the Jersey Shore. And there have been several times I've been inspired to swim out with the big boys pretty far out there and try to tackle waves that I probably shouldn't or have no business trying to tackle. And I've been held underwater for longer than I would have liked. But that's about as far as I go. That and following my brother-in-laws around out west when we go skiing, much better skiers than I am, and that's gotten me in a little bit of trouble.
Little known fact that I've never brought up on the pod. So I was born and raised in Southern California, close to Huntington Beach, and one of my uncles, he's actually like a close family friend, was a professional surfer and taught me to surf when I was younger. Obviously, since I moved to Florida, also not known for our waves out here. But when I was growing up in California from until about 12 years old, I spent my fair share of time out in the waves. I ask a little bit about the survivalist thing because I was thinking about it. My wife loves these shows like Naked and Afraid and Alone. And I'm always telling her, like, we're talking, how many days could you survive out there? And I'm telling her, I'm like, I think I could go at least a week or two. She's like, you're crazy. You won't even get up on a ladder to go on the roof. And you're telling me you're going to go survive in the wilderness? You have to hunt for yourself? And I'm like, I'm a survivor. I got this. So, you know what, Ken? We might have to figure it out. When we're going to go on one of these camping trips, I'm going to prove my wife wrong and show her that I can handle the elements, okay? If you go out there with me. Help me push my boundaries. All right. Now let's talk about professionally, okay? Is there a time where, because this is obviously something that's important to you in terms of where you're at and in your career as well. Is there a time that maybe you pushed your boundaries a little bit too far early on in your career and realized that being a little bit more measured or having that governor kind of pull you back is really important as you look to push your limits?
Yeah, I think so. Like early in my career, I started on the agency side, you know, and in an account role, in a creative conceptualization role, and that environment was very free flowing, let's say, you know, on the agency side with ideas, and always kind of considered myself a big idea guy. When I made the move over to the corporate side, you know, I had to kind of adjust and flex my style to a very different atmosphere. And I remember kind of getting excited in meetings and coming up with these ideas and expressing my thoughts in let's call them very colorful ways. And I think that kind of got people thinking, man, you know, this guy's really creative, but like, where's he going with all this stuff? And in order to bring people along, I learned I really needed to adapt my style and make sure that people saw the energy, the passion, the great thinking, the big ideas, but it was, you know, packaged, you know, in a way that was, let's say, a bit more subdued than you might expect, you know, on the agency side.
Yeah, I know you're on the lookout for your next opportunity. I'm interested, when you get in your next role and you're hired into your next role, what are you going to step into that company being like top 5%? What are people getting, like the new fully formed you that's been evolving over this time? You've been on the agency side, you've been in the C-level role, you've been in the corporate role. Like, what is it you bring to the table that might differentiate you from similar people who have had experience similar to your own?
I think, you know, my towering strength is really my creativity. I'm not only kind of personally creative, where you can lock me in a room and I'll come up with ideas that are well rooted in the business goals and overarching strategies. But I also have an ability to create an environment that enables people to feel kind of that their ideas are welcome, that it's safe to express their thoughts and ideas, and that they'll be recognized for great ideas that help move the business forward.
I love that. As you go through this process, I know that you want to be with companies that are growth oriented, the ones that are going to be open to kind of pushing their boundaries and taking, you know, good risk, right, to enable to kind of grow or do something really innovative or really creative. What can be really tough, though, is to understand that during an interview process or why what you're seeing online or what's externally facing versus what the real day-to-day like is in a company. How do you identify those types of companies in your interview process so you know you're walking into a place that's going to fit, you know, what your strengths are and your skills are?
Yeah, I think that's a really, really good question. And I would say, like, what you can do is you can look at the job description. You know, that job description may be more revealing than you think. For example, I recently read one that said, it was a Steve Jobs quote that they actually had right there in the job description. It said, people think focus means saying yes to the thing you've got to focus on, but that's not what it means at all. It means saying no to the 100 other good ideas that there are. And I thought, wow, what a really cool statement to make right within the job specification. And to me, that signaled that here's a company that really understands businesses don't fail because they starve from lack of good ideas. They fail because they drown in all the possibilities. And it's so important to keep an open aperture, but to have, you know, and have big audacious goals, but to have a framework that enables you to hone in on those few big bets that are going to be really big game changers. So to me, that signaled that this is a company that really gets it in terms of driving growth. And it enabled me to ask some probing questions when I had the opportunity.
Yeah, I mean, so I got a couple of things that stand out to me. I have a whiteboard in my room, and on the top of it, I wrote a quote: "There will always be more good ideas than there will be ability to execute against those ideas," right? As an entrepreneur and somebody that famously has constantly got the next great idea, I had to bring myself in and hone in my focus, because you're right. It's about, you know, not being mediocre at a bunch of things or chasing a bunch of different shiny objects. It's about really honing in and figuring out that one great idea, but then being incredibly focused on executing against it and taking and bringing it to reality. Ideas at the end of the day are a dime a dozen. The ability to execute is really, really key. So I love that. The other thing that you said that really stands out to me is, and I've talked about this many times on the pod, but you know, I really believe that recruiting in a lot of ways is marketing, right? And really actually fits more in the marketing realm, because you know, if you think about when a role goes out to market, obviously you're marketing it out to all the different people that you want to get the role. And part of that is the job description, right? The job description as this skills inventory or something that we cut and paste and put together, to me, is a real disservice to your company. If you think about it, it's one of the first touch points of any lead of somebody that's eventually going to work at your company. And yet we don't treat it that way. We have like this like skills box and like these, you know, you probably cut and paste it from Indeed.com and made a couple changes and changed your company name, where really you're trying to speak to the market about who you are, what you're about, and what you're going to do in this role. So one of the things that we try to do here at our company, we try to advise our clients, is what will you learn in this role? What will you get from this role? Why does this role make sense? And what type of person fits in this role, more so than bachelor's degree required or 10 years of digital marketing experience, right? Creating it and treating it like a marketing artifact, I think, is really a real smart thing that many companies are starting to pick up and learn. It's something that we've been advising for a while as being really, really key. On the same token, a resume is also a marketing artifact in a lot of ways, and what you're trying to capture and what you want to leave people with, much like a great advertisement, same thing with both of those documents. So love that. What is the way that once you're in the company that you've gotten leadership on board with having an appetite for risk, right? How would you advise people that, what are the tactics and guardrails that you can talk to leadership about to get them comfortable, especially if you're somebody new coming in, you got these ideas, might be a little bit like slow down, maybe that takes a little bit of time, but I'm just interested, how do you get people to understand that, hey, this risk is somewhat necessary, here's how we can hedge against it, here's the right way to go about it?
The best thing you can do there is demonstrate how taking certain risks that you're proposing align with the company's long-term strategic goals. And if they have customers, so if it's, let's say, a B2B to C business like I've worked in before, it's not only the company's long-term goals, but the customer's long-term goals, what the consumer is trying to achieve. So if you can demonstrate how these risks align with goals, it's not just about chasing shiny objects to try a whole bunch of things. You know, there's real purpose behind that. It's not random. It's part of a deliberate strategy to achieve growth.
Love that. One of the things that, you know, we do here, I think a lot about, is team building, right? Not just like picking out the most talented person and dropping them into a team. It's about figuring out how all these pieces fit together. And you said something to me about the importance of being opposite but complementary in terms of skills. I'm just interested, can you give me a work example of where you kind of had that perfect mix of team members who had opposite and complementary skills, and how you got everybody to mesh? Because sometimes, if you have those different skills, the way you communicate, the way you receive information, the way that you work might be completely different. So I'm just interested how you get those things to work together when they're diametrically opposed a lot of the times in terms of their skills.
Yeah, that's a great question, Oz. So when I was at Henkel, I led digital transformation and all 8 consumer communication groups, everything from media to digital to shopper marketing, internal creative services, even the call center. And my mission was to break down the internal silos within these functions so that we could create a better user experience ultimately, and you know, from media to shelf. And so what I had to do is not only kind of physically orient people so they were in close proximity to each other and they could work more collaboratively together, but also had to ensure that we were building and maintaining productive relationships, relationships built on, you know, respect for the individual and maintaining other people's dignity. Not, you know, it's very important to achieve great results, but do it in the right way. And to your point, there's so many different styles, and you don't want to curtail, you know, someone's natural style necessarily, but you may want them to adapt that style. And so when I came in, I said, look, number one, I want you to bring your whole self to work, right? You know, ideas and creativity, that is the lifeblood of innovation and of growth. And we need that from each and every one of you. We need your ideas and we need your own unique personal style. However, sometimes that style, you may need to adapt it, right? To ensure that you are conveying what you mean to convey in a way that is accessible to others. And I will demonstrate this to you. And I told everybody on my team, so about 30 people, I said, I don't want you to adapt to my style. I have a particular style. I don't want you to adapt to it. I will adapt to your style individually. So one person will make, you know, will make the changes versus 30 people making changes. And when I do that, I hope to model for you how my subtle changes in, let's say, my tone, my body language, how that makes you feel as we are sharing ideas. Do you feel I'm conveying my thoughts and ideas to you in a way that is kind of acceptable to you, in a way that you can hear that? And that really worked. People got that. And I felt that they were collaborating just wonderfully. And that came together, you know, with some really big ideas. And I'd be happy to share an example.
Yeah, go ahead, share an example.
So I'm sitting in my office and I have the call center, you know, a person who runs a call center right outside of my office, and everything's glass so I can see her. And I see her just laughing and she's just having a great time. And she's looking at these colored pieces of paper. And I come out of my office and I say, Melody, what's going on? Looks like you're having a great time. Let me in on it. And she goes, Ken, you're not going to believe this. You know, we are getting love letters from our consumers. I said, love letters? What are you talking about? Well, people are sending us, you know, these notes that extol the virtues of Persil, our laundry detergent brand, our top laundry detergent brand in globally and in the US. And I read these letters and it was really crazy. I mean, in a good sense, you know, people were talking. There's one woman that said her husband was not an effusive guy, but he came home from work after a day of work and he kissed his wife and thanked her for the laundry. He smelled so good and felt so good, it actually made him feel better that day. And that is truth. And we looked at that and we looked at these letters and we went online and we looked at our ratings and reviews more carefully. And we saw that one after the other, we saw all these incredible over-the-top, you know, comments about the Persil laundry detergent brand, much different than what we saw from our competitors. And so we took that idea. So this woman had a penchant for deeply understanding, you know, the consumer, right? That was her job. It's her vocation. And she brought that insight to me. I took that insight to others, to people who were big idea thinkers, right? And they came up with several big ideas and ways that we could leverage this insight into a communication strategy. And when the idea was shaped, I brought that to real solid tacticians, you know, commercial operators, you know, who were able to think about all the little nitty-gritty details of a media plan and a shopper activation plan. And they kind of fleshed out the executional details. And then we brought all of that work to some of our analytic friends on the team who were really, really great at sussing out leading and lagging indicators and measurement methodologies that would really help us understand quickly, you know, how this campaign was doing so we could optimize in real time and end up with a great, you know, return on ad spend. And at the end of the day, we ended up improving our ad spend from from what we were targeting to over $6. So $6 in revenue for every dollar invested from a return on ad spend investment.
Wow. What a fantastic story. I think maybe I'm later in the day. I'm at a 7 out of 10 on my laundry detergent. It looks like I need to go buy some Purcell because I'm certainly not coming home and hugging and kissing my wife because of the laundry. Maybe I should. Maybe that's a mistake on my part. That's fantastic. I love to feel people getting emotive and excited and engaged about the products. That's got to feel good as a marketer. And they're just giving you like kindling right there to kind of set it on fire. So that's awesome. It's always better to market when you've got a fantastic product. What a great story. I appreciate you sharing that. Consumer packaged goods, CPG, as an industry, I mean, I've known this throughout my career. Whenever we've worked on any marketing roles, and we're lucky to have a bunch of CPG clients, but even when we're not working with CPG clients and they're looking for marketing talent, a lot of times they want us to go to that industry and bring it into their company, even if it's technology or retail or financial services or whatever it may be. I'm just interested, why do you think companies target CPG? What is it about like the process there or the offerings there that leads to, you know, the great creative and marketing minds that have kind of spent their time in that space?
That's a great question. And I think it's a couple of things. I think first and foremost, it's highly competitive, right? Fast moving consumer goods, you know, is there many, many brands competing for limited consumer attention on very crowded shelf spaces, right? And so this requires CPG marketers to place a strong emphasis on understanding consumer behavior, preferences, and trends. And they, you know, invest the time and the effort and the resources to really do the market research and the data analytics to surface searing consumer insights, right? And tailor those insights to marketing strategies that don't just solve the functional consumer problem, but also emotional consumer problems and social ideas that consumers have about themselves that they want to articulate through their brand choices.
Wow. Let me ask you something. You worked in CPG throughout your career. What was the product that you got the most unsolicited customer excitement about? Was it Purcell or was it something else? Something at PepsiCo?
No. That was Mountain Dew. Mountain Dew was like no other. I mean, people were actually tattooing the logo on their bodies. You know, they love that product. And it wasn't just adrenaline seeking kids. It was, you know, really all ages, all demographics that really tapped into the exhilarating lifestyle that Mountain Dew was providing a window into. And so that was just incredible. And it led me to do a little bit of research. And I found that one out of three Mountain Dews was purchased at Walmart. And so Walmart was a really big customer of ours. And I was like, you know what? I met with the buyer and I met with the marketing folks at Walmart. I said, we got to celebrate, you know, the Walmart shoppers' love of Mountain Dew. We got to celebrate it. And I came up with an idea called the Year of Dew. And what we were going to do is we were going to bring Walmart shoppers exclusive products, packages, and experiences all year long that they could only get at Walmart. And that program was so successful because it tapped into the deep love that people had at Mountain Dew, the Walmart shoppers had for Mountain Dew. And the program, we ran the program for 3 years. It generated tens of millions of dollars in incremental sales.
I love that. I'm going to put my hand up. If you go onto our website, you'll see under my leadership profile that this was outdated, but I drank a lot of Diet Mountain Dew in my day. It's one of the best tasting. I remember it's one of the products that like it doesn't even taste like it's diet and it's great. And obviously a great caffeine jolt. I remember me and one of the former partners, we used to have like, we'd buy our two Mountain Dews a day, Diet Mountain Dews a day, and use that to get us through the day. I also remember, and this is from a long time ago, the Get Vertical with Mountain Dew marketing program from way back in the day. Do you have any sense of how they came up with the name or any of the kind of origin story around Mountain Dew or?
Well, how they came up? Yes. Well, Mountain Dew, oh boy, Mountain Dew back in the, 50s or whenever. It was developed in the South. And it was the whole idea, it was really about refreshment and reinforcing kind of refreshment cues and It was literally the dew that you could find early morning on the mountain. And they felt like that was, at the time, an image that would convey refreshment.
And what's funny about that is the brand is a little bit edgier and like mountain bikers and skateboarders and teenagers and video game players. But then you have this beautiful thought of Mountain Dew, a dew out in the mountain as you wake up in the morning. Wow. What a story. Wow, who knew we were gonna get the Mountain Dew origin story here? I'm so excited. I'm gonna get me a Diet Mountain Dew right after this. I need some more energy maybe. All
Yeah,
right.
now I don't think people really make those associations with the mountain and the actual, water left on the grass and the leaves. I think if
No.
anything, they probably think about, Mountain Dew, D-O, like, go out and do it.
Go and do. Oh, I didn't even think about that. That makes great sense. Today's episode of Higher Learning brought to you by Purcell Laundry Detergent and Mountain Dew. Maybe we can get some sponsors lined up here, Ken. Make a call for
There
me.
you go. I love
All
it.
right, we do got to pay the bills, so that's what we got to do. We got to talk about hiring. Now, you've done a lot of hiring throughout your career. I'm really interested. We'll start here. What's a core hiring philosophy for anybody that you bring into your marketing organization?
Well, I really want to understand what's your secret sauce. Everybody's got a secret sauce, a certain way of doing things, right? So, for example, if you asked me that question, I would say, you know what? I specialize in transforming marketing departments into engines of profitable growth. I've developed, strategies that drive the consumer life cycle from awareness and conversion to repeat and loyalty. And these are highly adaptive strategies that are optimized with real-time data, right? I've done this at large corporations like PepsiCo and Henkel and smaller private equity-backed firms like Sun Products and Dr. Prager's. Full stop, done, right? So that is my elevator speech for my secret sauce, kind of what I do. People, I think, in an interview don't really want to know so much about, they want to hear what you do versus who you are, right? I've got the resume, so I kind of know who you are. And yes, I'm interested in that to some degree, but I want to know what you do and what makes you different. And how am I going to assess that based on who I have on the team already? Remember, I'm looking for those complementary skills. And so if you tell me kind of what your secret sauce is and how you do things, A, I know you put a lot of thought into your kind of unique, relevant, personal brand value proposition, and B, it better helps me understand where kind of you could help the team, grow.
I love that. Tell me your secret sauce. All right, what about if I asked you about a memorable interview experience? Maybe one you were interviewing for, or you were interviewing somebody. When I ask you that, what comes to mind?
Oh my gosh, I was recently interviewing, and I thought this was fantastic. And this person said to me, "So what's your hot take?" And I'm like, so fortunately I have four kids, right? And I
Me
know
too. Four kids
four
club. Let's do
kids.
it. Yeah, four kids, three girls and a boy. How many you got? Yes.
I've got one girl and three boys.
Oh my God. We should start a softball team. All right, go
Let's
ahead.
do it.
Yeah.
So I know what hot take is, right? So the term hot take means kind of like, what's your kind of controversial opinion or perspective, right, that you have on a current relevant business topic, right?
Okay.
And so for me, I was like, you need to get finance in the ideation process early. And the person said, "What? What do you mean by that? I mean, those folks, they're not always the most creative. They sometimes are naysayers." I'm like, "No. Get them in early, because what you want to find out early is you want to understand what is your target consumers, what are their needs, right? What are their values in terms of what attributes of your product do they value most, and what is their willingness to pay? You want to be thinking about the price range, at least, of what you are developing from an innovation perspective from the get-go. The worst thing you can do is come up with a great innovation idea that where you leave tons of money on the table. And by bringing finance into the conversation early, not only will you be surprised of the great ideas that can come from that group, but you're thinking about willingness to pay upfront, which is so important.
I love that. I'm thinking about some hot takes I got myself kind of in my space, my industry. I'm in software, talking a lot about AI. I've said a lot of things like, I think AI is going to be demonstrably very good, more so than bad, as we hear some of the dystopian things. I definitely believe that. AI is not going to replace your job. Somebody who learns AI is going to replace your job. But here's my new one. AI is going to change software development like the microwave changed cooking. So to that end, everybody's talking a lot right now about how now we can 5x developers, and now everybody's going to be a developer, and everyone's going to have these micro apps, and it's going to completely change everything. And I actually, at least for the next 5 to 10 years, as somebody that's knee-deep in this space right now, I'm thinking about it. I think there's more art to it than that. I think there's more fine gourmet outputs to it than that. And so while I think there's going to be a help in productivity, or I think it's going to change things in a very positive way and make us more productive, to say that it's going to replace 5-star meals, I just don't see it. Not yet. Not now. So that is my not fully formed, half-baked hot take that I'm working on right now. What do you think, Ken? You
I
into it?
think that's great. And my son is in college and he's studying math and statistics, right? He is very, very involved in artificial intelligence, and he's using AI to your point, code. And he does know how to code, but he can use AI and get the coding done much quicker, and it enables him to think about the solution he's developing more. And be more creative and innovative.
Who knew we were going to go on an AI tangent there? I love it. All right, next question. What's your favorite question to ask in an interview?
My favorite question to ask in an interview is, what are you most proud of in your career? And I love to see that people give me not only, an impassioned answer, but also an answer that is concise but tied to a result, So at the end of the day, I want to see that people are lining up things that they really get charged up over, but at the but at the end of the day, those things are driving business results. So I want to see them light up not only on the idea or the thing that they were involved in that was so rewarding, but that it actually had substantial impact on the organization. Because at the end of the day, it isn't about doing a lot of activities, right? At the end of the day, it's about impact. And we certainly want to align what people are passionate, about with their jobs, but we've always got to be focused on driving growth.
Okay, Ken, I know you are a religious listener of Higher Learning and you've listened to every single podcast, so you know that this is coming right here. We flip the question on you. What are you most proud of professionally?
Wow, what am I most proud of professionally? I
I
would
answer
say
it too, because I will make sure that I eat my own dog food.
So I think what I am most proud of professionally is really my time at Henkel. I came into the Henkel organization, and they really were looking for marketing transformation. And I had left PepsiCo, right? I went to go work for a PE-backed company called Sun Products. And Sun Products created a position for me to drive digital transformation. And they had a $3.5 billion exit to Henkel. Right. Henkel bought Sun Products and they offered me the opportunity to join them. And they said, Ken, we really like what you're doing at Sun Products and how you've built the digital practice and are really building brand equity and driving sales in modern ways. And we'd like you to do that for us. We'd like you to help us, transition, transform our marketing department. And that's exactly what I did. I had kind of like a four-tier strategy. Number one, outside of evaluating the team and reorganizing the structure of the marketing team under my jurisdiction, it really was all about leveraging content. It was about elevating brand meaning through powerful stories that were inspirational, educational, and provided some, utility. It was about moving from a multi-channel, somewhat, disjointed approach to an omni-channel, well-orchestrated approach to marketing. And it was about devising, implementing, and monitoring digital practices across the enterprise that, improved our return on investment by, 2-3x. It was about value creation process, right? Implementing a value creation process where we were able to save over $25 million in the first 2 years, and that money could be reinvested into the brands. At the end of the day, we were able to, from a marketing perspective, grow marketing's contribution to sales by 17%, and marketing's contribution to return on investment by 7% versus what they were ever able to achieve in the past. And that was seen as a really significant achievement. It was all encompassing. And I feel really proud about that.
I love that. All right, Ken, now you ask me.
What are you most proud of in your career?
Yeah, so I'm having a hard time deciding between two things, so I'm going to list them both. I think over time, one will overtake the other. But the first thing that I'm most proud of is I'm most proud of the culture that we've built in this company and how impactful it is in terms of our bottom line productivity as a company. Our culture is something that is felt, it's iterated, it's evolved, it's always has an opportunity to improve, but it's palpable, and I don't think that's easy to do. And so that culture that we built here at our company at MSH and Aon is something I'm very proud of. I know it's one of the first things people talk about when they're here, and that doesn't mean that every day it's perfect or that it's always puppy dogs and lollipops, but I know it's a big reason why people keep coming back, why we have the tenure we do, why we have the company we do. So that's one of the biggest bottom line reasons for it. The second thing I would say is the people that have developed under the company and my leadership is something I'm also very, very proud of. And I think this is the one that over time will continue to overtake, because I think some of these people still have immense opportunity to continue to do some amazing transformative things. But nothing makes me happier than watching somebody that had skills, had talent, came into our environment, our incubator. We did a good job of cultivating them. They did a good job of putting in the work to get where they needed to go. And then you just watch them grow and the trajectory, and it's just one of the proudest things. As somebody that has four kids like you do, it's also something that watching them go through these milestones and these development and knowing you played a part in that is very gratifying. And so that continues to be something that I'm very, very proud of. And I think over time, as I look back at the, you know, they talk about a coaching tree. I'm big into sports, and you know, Greg Popovich's coaching tree and Bill Belichick's coaching tree. I'd like to have a coaching tree one day that's like, these are the people that came from our organization that have gone on to do amazing, brilliant things, whether it be here at our company or somewhere else. So those are the two things I'm proud of.
I love that. In fact, both of those things are, you know, focused on people, right? Which is so important. And it's the lifeblood of your business and of every business. And the fact that you're looking to create, you know, a high performance culture based on what sounds like really, you know, fulfillment of people's aspirations on an individual, you know, level sounds wonderful.
Well, I think one of the things that is really like missed in today's work environment is that ultimately these relationships have to be reciprocal, where the employee is getting something out of their time and obviously the company is getting something out of the time. But the reality is that we have a collective shared interest, right? When the company does well, almost always it means the individual does well, whether it be from a development perspective, a financial perspective, whatever it be. And yet sometimes it feels like these two forces are pulling away from each other, or there's a lack of trust. And I think that's really, really bad. And I think the best companies are the ones that understand that these two things work together. Your success is our success and vice versa. But we can always accomplish a lot more collectively than we can individually. And that's why we work together in these teams, in these groups, in these organizations. And so that's something that's really important to me and something that's been important for our company. So I appreciate that. Thank you. Sounds like you're hiring me. I accept. When do I start?
Yeah, I was going to say the same thing to you. You're the kind of person I want to work for. And I know that books are really important to you because I've listened to your podcast. And so I'm going to beat you to the punch.
Oh, no. Here we go. Let's do it.
You know, and so I am looking here and I'm pulling a book from my shelf here that you mentioned trust, right? And there is an incredible book that that has stayed with me for a very long time. It's called The
Speed of Trust. Yes, by the guy, Seven Habits, Covey. Covey's son, Stephen Covey.
It is really, really great. So he said the subheadline is "The One Thing That Changes Everything." And boy, it's really true. And if you read this book, you really understand how far trust can go to accelerating business growth and fulfillment of employees.
Yeah, and listen, the speed of trust is important because especially in sales or in interviews, in these moments where you have a very finite amount of time before people make a read on you and understand if they want to work with you or work for you or any of that, can you establish authentically who you are and build that trust? Because you can't do that in a disingenuous way on enough scale. Like, you just can't. You can fool some people some of the time, but on a long enough timeline, people are going to figure out who you are. So can you be your authentic self and build that trust? And once you do, now you can start to move at a speed and you can start to work at a speed. There it is. It's a great book. I've read that one. Really love it. One of the first things I did early in my career is I went to a Stephen Covey, Seven Habits training. And I think it informed a lot of who I was as a professional. I very appreciate the company subsidizing my ability to get that training because I think it helped and it's paid off in spades. So love it. Love the book recommendation. Back to the hiring real quick. We all miss sometimes. So when I ask you about when you look back on times you've missed or if there's a theme or kind of a through line, is there anything that like, yeah, man, I wish I would have done this differently? Or what comes up when I say that?
Yeah, that's a really good question. And fortunately, I haven't missed a lot, but certainly we all make hiring decisions that we think about and we say, was that really the best choice? And I think, it's probably come down, to not asking, enough questions to really understand whether or not the person is a cultural fit. I haven't had any issues with from a functional perspective, right? Where people come into the job and they just can't do the job. There's enough focus on the functional piece. It's the cultural piece where in the past, there's one in particular, that I'm thinking of. Gee, did I press hard enough, earlier in my career, when I was a newer hiring manager on the cultural fit? Just like you talked about how important culture is, it really does eat strategy for breakfast. And, one, let's call them overly cynical, overly pessimistic person can really, really, really cause some damage.
Sure.
And it takes a lot to dig out of that.
Love that. Totally right. All right, what about let's flip it. If I ask you to think about the best hire you've ever made, does somebody come to mind? Is
It's
any
gonna, I'm gonna flip it on 10. I have the person in my head and I'm just smiling, right? And this person was really a culture giver. Not only was this person very smart and extremely poised under pressure, and when they made mistakes, I loved it because when the mistakes happened, they weren't frequent, but when they did happen, the person would come right to me, right? Didn't try to sweep it under the rug and demonstrated the right behavior. Hey, look, Ken, this is what happened. This is what I plan on doing about it. Do you have any questions? Here's the potential risks, right, to various stakeholders in the organization. This is what I plan on doing, but I wanted to check in with you to get your input before I made a move. And I just thought, man, that is a great demonstration of doing it the right way. And if our culture can kind of embrace what you're doing, sure, mistakes happen, face them, stare reality in the face. Let's work together as a team quickly to resolve them. That's the way it should be done.
Did you know in the interview right away, or was it something you're like, well, we got to see, and then it turned out being way better than you thought?
Oh no, I knew in the interview right away. And I knew I had to have this person. It took us a year to find the right person, and we weren't going to settle. And we found the right person, and I knew it. And I moved as quickly as I could to bring that person on board, and I'm happy to say I was right. And to your point, in terms of the tree, that person has gone on. They're a successful CMO right now. And I've recently been a feeder into their organization, recommending talent for this person to continue to build his team out.
I love that. Gosh, did you see how happy you were and the smile you had when you thought about that person? That's what a great hire will do. It's such a game changer. It's really exponential. It's like 100 years of compound interest. Like, I don't think people understand how, we all think we're really good at hiring, but the reality is that we make some mistakes, we make some good hires. But man, when you get it just right, God, it's like a game changer. It's like picking the right spouse. It's like picking the right, favorite location to live in because it's got everything you want. I mean, I don't know. It's such an important thing, and it's why I give so much importance to it. I love to hear that story, and it does not surprise me to hear that person's gone on to great success. All right, let me ask you this. What have you been doing? I know you've been in a little bit of a transition. Sounds like you've been interviewing, doing some things. Is there anything you're doing right now, like to kind of, you're really juiced about? Have you picked up any new hobbies? Are you spending more time with family? Like, what are you doing right now to kind of, that's kind of keeping you going?
You know what? Well, that's a great question. And so what I'm doing is I'm working right now with an accelerator, and I'm helping, seed-funded companies improve their odds at success as a marketing advisor. And I'm working with this incubator that brings together business advisors with startup founders. And these companies are very, very small, maybe a couple of $1 million in top-line sales. And what I'm helping them do is not only kind of brand strategy work, and teaching them about, you know, brand, you know, about consumer segmentation and brand positioning, and innovation considerations. But I'm also helping them think through how are they going to execute a marketing, a go-to-market strategy for very, very small amount of money, right? Mm. What agency partners or consultants can I connect them with that aren't going to break the bank? Because these founders have no time to do marketing. They need to outsource it. But how can they focus on a couple of key objectives from a marketing perspective and stay maniacally focused on those things to drive, you know, their business forward? So that could be, look, this brand, they've got great velocity and they're growing distribution. They got to grow awareness. How do they do that on a budget? Or, man, you know what? Velocity isn't what it needs to be. How do they address that on a budget? And I find that work to be fascinating.
I really like that. I'm going to follow up with you on that because I've been doing a lot of work right now on segmentation and positioning and thinking. So I'm going to want to pick your brain on this. I'm going to follow up with you on that a little bit. All right.
Please do.
You stole my thunder on the book stuff. So I appreciate that. Now I'm going to throw another curveball at you, though, because this is what I like to do. You got a movie or TV show or any other type of content that you want to throw out there for the people?
Oh, man. Yes, I do. You know what? I just rewatched on Netflix. I watched Band of Brothers again.
Great. Great.
And I have to tell you, it was just absolutely shocking to me how young these kids were and how poised they were. And I remember at PepsiCo had the habit of hiring vets. And I remember they hired this guy and he wrote a book about his time, his experience in I believe it was Iraq. And the book was called Joker One. And it is an incredible book. And he was working at PepsiCo, you know, and I called him up and I said, man, would you just spend a few minutes talking to me about this? And he did. And I said, how did a 20-year-old kid like you, how did you keep it together? How could you stay poised under literal fire? And he talked to me a little bit about that. And I think with Band of Brothers and with this experience with this particular combat veteran and author, I mean, I was just so impressed with how these young people could function at such a high level under so much duress.
It's really, really incredible. And like, you know, we've been fortunate in our lives to not be faced with as much of it as obviously in World War One, World War Two, Vietnam. But you don't come back from war the same person, and most of the time not in a very good way. So much respect for our vets. And everybody who does that and puts their life on the line for our country, it means a lot. You know, I will say this, who knew my father-in-law was going to get shouted out twice, but he loves Band of Brothers. It's great. He went and did the actual tour in Europe, I believe through Normandy and like all, through all different things. So it's really, really cool. You know, here's the one thing I'm not going to forgive them for, though, because I love Band of Brothers. What the hell is Jimmy Fallon doing in there, though? It was almost like, well, come on. What, Jimmy Fallon? Who did the casting for that? Does not fit in Band of Brothers. That's my personal take. Nothing against Jimmy Fallon. Not my favorite comedian. Would not have cast him. One man's opinion. I got a lot of hot takes coming out today. We're going to end it right here, Ken. If you were able to amplify one nugget of career advice for young Ken, 20-year-old Ken, that you didn't know then but that you know now, what would it be?
One piece of career advice that I know now that I didn't know then, I would say that it all works out in the end. And if it hasn't worked out, it's not the end.
Oof, I like that. It all works out in the end. And if it hasn't worked out, it's not the end. That's a good, I like that.
Take it light. You know what? It's Monday's problems, right? These are issues. They're all issues that we face in business every day that can feel stressful and feel overwhelming. It's not like Band of Brothers and going to war. It's important. It's serious. But it's all going to work out. You can find a way. You're going to be pressed to be a better version of yourself and learn and develop new skills, and you will work it out.
Ken, I really enjoyed our time. I appreciate you coming on the show. You've given us so many great insights to take away. Thank you for spending some time. I also want to thank our sponsors, Mountain Dew and Purcell Laundry Detergent. Thank you so much for everything you do for the show. Appreciate you, my friend. Have a good one.
You too, Oz.
Talk to you later.